actually hit the roads from Thanksgiving to the Christmas holidays, including New Year. So as a result, gasoline prices at the pump will increase dramatically. Now a look at the release from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Yes, U.S. announced that it would release close to or at 50 million barrels, the estimated release amount. And this is going to be a combination of a loan and a sale. In other words, the 50 million barrels that comes from the SPR is going to be set out there, whether it's a loan or a sale, to the different distributors. However, many market experts have said that this will not have a sustained effect on oil prices. And guess what? They were right. The international oil prices rose significantly after the announcement that was made by the U.S. All right, let's get a breakdown on this and bring in Tom Sullivan. He's the director at Matthias Energy Consulting firm who rejoins us here. Well, Tom, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. to releasing these 50 million barrels of oil? I mean, along with other countries, it's done that. It's going to affect the price of oil somewhat. Your opinion matters here. OPEC doesn't like that. At the same time, when the announcements were made, prices did go up. So can you break this down for us?
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, sir. So I think, obviously, yes, higher oil prices are causing a major problem for President Biden in the United States. First of all, the prices at the gasoline the prices at the pump in the gasoline stations in the United States. And as you said, also the higher inflation costs. So I think, obviously, the United States felt some pressure to actually ask all of its allies, countries, and of course China as well, to release reserves. And Japan has done that and has agreed to do that. And of course South Korea in this time zone also has agreed to do that. But I think also OPEC, because of the sustained period of low oil prices, I think were a little reluctant to increase production too much. Gavi, so I think that's a little bit of background from my perspective in this time zone.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. Well, let's bring in Sergio Takeshita. He rejoins us. He's a professor of management and information at the University of Shizuoka. Sergio, tell us your take on why the U.S. decided to make this move. Obviously, it felt the pressure because of inflation along with other nations. At the same time, OPEC does not like that. And then you have what should have been a price decrease, but yet the price increased.
Well, I think one of the big problems that we're facing, as you just noted, is the fear of inflation, which has become pretty evident, not only through the high oil prices, but also due to the pent-up demand that's really kicking in many of the countries. Now, the aim of OPEC, or OPEC Plus, is basically to sustain high price, particularly for the likes of Saudi Arabia. Now, that said, organizations like OPEC tend to be very wide in variations. You have one of the richest and also one of the poorest countries in the world. The only similarity here is the fact that they produce oil. But, you know, some go for the higher price, some just go for the cash that they can get a hold on. So it's a very difficult organization, in my opinion, to sustain, you know, an opinion. But here, I think it's very clear that the leader, Saudi Arabia, obviously wants to sustain the high price.
What can the world do to increase oil and gas availability and in turn decrease the energy crunch that it finds itself in? OPEC Plus has not been that accommodating on this issue, but there is one solution. Get oil and gas producing countries into the mix. The largest oil producing countries in the world, numbers 1 and 3, namely Venezuela and Iran. Their proven oil reserves are astronomical. The problem? Both are under U.S. sanctions. And because of these sanctions, the rest of the world is suffering, even the U.S. itself. In terms of Iran, It is the fifth largest crude oil producer in OPEC in 2020. At the end of 2020, Iran accounted for 25% of oil reserves in West Asia and for 12% in the world. The EIA assesses that Iran's production could return to full capacity at around 4 million barrels per day if the United States lifts oil sector sanctions.
With the announcement of the U.S. President Joe Biden that it, along with some other countries, will release their oil reserves into markets, a clash is now in the making between the U.S. and world's top oil producers, namely OPEC. First, let's set the stage. At stake is the price of the world's most important commodity, namely oil. Why is this happening? Politicians and central bankers, content with the strongest inflationary surge in more than a decade. What is OPEC saying about all of this? First, it's not too happy about the release of U.S. oil reserves, and this is how they have responded, which sounds like a threat in some ways. OPEC delegates said the release of millions of barrels from the inventories of their biggest customers is unjustified by current market conditions, and the group may have to reconsider plans to add more oil production when they meet next week.
Everybody's sure of this. OPEC is going to fight back by simply adjusting their production, okay? So they can drive the price right back up by failing to increase production as much as perhaps they would have otherwise.
The problem that OPEC sees here is the price of oil, and who controls it and sets it has a precedent. OPEC believes that it should determine what the price of oil should be based on the demand and conditions that affect the price of the precious commodity. But herein lies the problem. The U.S. believes that OPEC should increase production to offset the price and lower it. But OPEC disagrees.
Why did we do that 400? Keep in mind, I think you guys have a good memory, you know. Out of sheer responsibility, we brought an advancement to the whole 5.8. Let's not forget, the 5.8 million was out there to be dealt with beginning of May 22. Out of sheer responsibility, we brought the whole thing earlier, and that's why we have signed up to the July agreement, 18th of July agreement, where we will bring the 400.
One of the fallouts from this is the Saudi-U.S. relationship. The strained relationship between Washington and Riyadh is showing itself. This has been especially noticeable with the way Joe Biden views or doesn't view Mohammed bin Salman. There are headlines like these, which imply the high oil price is driven by Mohammed bin Salman and the uncozy relationship, or lack of it, that exists between him and the U.S. President Joe Biden. One headline read, "The main driver of inflation is a murderous maniac in Riyadh. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is enacting revenge on Democrats in general and President Joe Biden specifically for the party's increasingly standoffish attitude toward the kingdom by driving up energy prices and fueling the global inflation." But there is an important fact that the U.S. president is not facing or fails to realize when it comes to oil producers. It is how U.S. has made enemies out of major oil-producing countries through its failed policies. We told you about its relationship with Saudi Arabia Crown Prince. Then comes Russia and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Well, the U.S. is doing everything it can to corner Russia, forgetting Russia is the number two producer of oil in the world. And here's something many don't realize. Russia is supplying more oil to the U.S. than any other, aside from Canada. Aside from that estranged relationship, there is Iran. The U.S. has also failed there, preventing through sanctions Iranian oil from flowing into the market. Word of advice to the U.S. president, shutting your doors on major oil producers is not a good idea, something the U.S. is now suffering from. That does it for this segment of the program. I really look forward to any comments from you. Our links and addresses are on your screens now. From me, Matthew, it's goodbye until next week.
The future price of oil in the near and in the short term is actually something that's in the uncharted territory. It's hard to gauge what's going to happen. Now, remember when oil went into negative territory when the pandemic first hit? You couldn't even give the oil away for free. There was no storage space for it. Well, those days are gone. And with a new coronavirus strain, if it ravages the world economically, there will be an economic downturn as a result, which means demand will drop. But this could be an uneven phenomenon in the way that it's going to unfold. However, you can be sure that OPEC is going to make sure that it doesn't take a hit like last time around. That does it for this edition of the program. For me, Kavit Havway, and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Kettle whistling. Well, I think this is one of the relaxing sounds at home. Two teaspoons of loose tea in the teapot. Then hot water. Now I put the teapot on the kettle and let the tea be brewed up on a low burner stove. Nothing is more enjoyable than a calm home. One of the relaxing factors for a home is the architecture. architecture is a type of art which has been of much importance since very past times. In the history of art, many buildings have been built around the world which shine like glittering gems. Today we are going to visit one of these buildings, Saroye Roshan, located in the capital city of Tehran. Saroye Roshan is the name of a beautiful building in Tehran which has attracted many visitors. The building was built in 1932. Regarding its history and architecture, this building is very valuable. Saroye Roshan is one of the first commercial centers of old Tehran and is located in the middle of Nasser Khosro Street near Marvi Ali. The architecture of Saroye Roshan is inspired by Gothic architecture. This building was damaged after a period of time, but it was repaired beautifully by the well-known Iranian architect Kamran Safomanesh about 3 decades ago. In this building, the combination of Iranian and European elements of architecture are used. The decorations of pillars and statues of the building are inspired by Baroque architecture in Europe. Ahura Mazda design, which is the symbol of Achaemenid era, and the traditional tile works, which are the symbols of Islamic Iranian art, are used in this building. I am now at Nasser Khosro Street. This street is one of the crowded streets of Tehran. It's not a long way to Saroye Roshan, and I hope that my destination be less crowded so that you could hear my voice better. I am now next to Saroye Roshan. Here is one of the earliest commercial centers of old Tehran. This place used to be a busy place, yet today is not booming as before. Nowadays, Saroye Roshan consists of some shops and a big yard. There is a very big basement in this market, which is being used as a place for storing goods. Let me get a little closer to this structure in order to watch its beauties. I am now in front of the magnificent entrance of Saroye Roshan. The balconies and tall pillars of this mansion are among the aesthetic elements of this building. Oh, look. On top of the wall, there are statues of angels. How beautiful! Just beneath the statues of angels, which are the symbols of European architecture, there is Ahura Mazda design. And below it, there is a big window. And in front of the window, there is a beautiful balcony. 6 windows are situated next to this window symmetrically. Over and below the windows are decorated with beautiful blue Iranian tiles. Oh, this building is very beautiful. Thank you. Some of the designs in Saroy Roshan building include winged sun, winged bodies, column capitals with beautiful decorations, and colorful, attractive designs, which I can hardly describe them. If you happen to travel to Tehran, surely visit Saroy Roshan and enjoy its beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia, with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions, as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences.
In the case of Ukraine, I think the Russian government has a right to be concerned that that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is being played as a puppet of U.S. financial interests, U.S. political interests.
Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Barber, a far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Barber described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Barber further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Bobart apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Bobart's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Bobart over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Bobart posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this, instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter- and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result of Trumpian politics.
Anti-Muslim sentiment continued during the 2016 election cycle, during which Islamophobic hate crimes surged again. It is widely believed that the rise in hate to the anti-Muslim rhetoric was linked to the political discourse espoused by the political establishment in the U.S., especially the Republican Party and the people who gathered around former U.S. President Donald Trump, made Islam and Muslims targets of criticism throughout his presidential campaign and tenure.
It's going to continue to be incredibly divisive from a domestic perspective, and it is going to, I think, drive more and more and more white supremacist, white nationalist policy, whether it be domestic or whether it be foreign. And I also think from a domestic violence perspective, we are going to see more and more examples of individuals taking matters into their own hands, using their own firearms, and attacking fellow citizens.
During the first months of the Trump administration, it was reported that roughly 75% of Muslim American adults said that there's a lot of discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Shortly into his time in office, Trump signed an executive order that barred immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Islam has been seen in the Western world in a negative light, which is fueling the wave of Islamophobic attacks on Muslims.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia, with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions, as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences. Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
last Thursday, South Africa reported cases diagnosed with a heavily mutated variant of the novel coronavirus, later named Omicron. On Monday, the World Health Organization said the new variant is expected to raise the number of infections worldwide, warning that any spike in cases could have huge consequences.
Omicron's very emergence is another reminder that although many of us might think we're done with COVID-19, it's not done with us. We're living through a cycle of panic and neglect. Hard-won gains could vanish in an instant. Our most immediate task, therefore, is to end this pandemic.
The United Nations health body says more studies need to be run to establish the new strain's feared resistance to vaccines and previous infections.
Well, I think that the scare value, as time goes on, of talking about these new variants of concern falls. Now, they say in markets that you buy the rumor and you sell on the fact. Well, there's quite a few rumors circulating about this virus, but the facts that are known are very little.
Several countries scrambled to ban flights from South Africa and a number of other African countries affected by the new variant, stranding thousands of passengers there. The travel bans have drawn the ire of South Africa, with President Cyril Ramaphosa saying such moves will only cause more damage to his people.
At the same time, we need to resist unjustified as well as unscientific travel restrictions that only serve to further disadvantage developing economies.
Ramaphosa also stressed that developing countries, including those in Africa, need to manufacture their own vaccines. He called on the World Trade Organization to facilitate Africa's access to medical care. On Friday, global markets shed some $2 trillion after reports emerged suggesting that the new Omicron variant might be resistant to the existing vaccines. Although the prices recovered later on Monday, the drop exposed the vulnerability of the global economy, which is still reeling from the pandemic's aftershocks. The announcement of the new strain spread panic similar to when the pandemic first began.
Yes, the markets are riled up badly because all these rumors have started to circulate. But I believe that when people find out the facts of this variant, that the markets will calm down and hopefully it will not be used cynically by those in power to grab more authority.
In an attempt to allay the fears, U.S. President Joe Biden said the new variant is a cause for concern, but not a cause for panic.
We do not yet believe that additional measures will be needed, but so that we are prepared, if needed, my team is already working with officials at Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson to develop contingency plans for vaccines or boosters if needed.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said on Monday it was too soon to tell if Omicron will have any impact on global supply chains. But according to estimates by American investment bank Goldman Sachs, in case the Omicron variant proves deadlier and more contagious than its predecessor, Delta, the global economic growth will slow to a 2% quarter-on-quarter annual rate, that is, 2.5 percentage points below the bank's current forecast. The bank predicts that the growth in 2022 as a whole would be 4.2% or 0.4 percentage points below its forecast. Yet the new variant has already made its impact and is expected to influence consumer and corporate confidence ahead of the holiday season. That won't be a good sign for what we can expect in the months to come.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
جوان نخبه ما باید دنبال این باشه. خلاقیت در دانش. و حالا فرض بفرمایید که مثلا نیروی جاذبه حالا مثال های قدیمیش ایناست دیگه از قدیم این مثال ها رو می زدیم نیروی جاذبه وجود داشت یکی اینو کشف کرد بر اساس او دانش هایی به وجود آمد
Our outstanding youth must pursue this creativity in science For example, there was gravity These are common old examples that I have been using for a long time Someone discovered this and science was created based on it There was the power of electricity in nature, but no one knew about it until someone discovered it. Based on this discovery, this vast field of science and technology was created. The same is true of new sciences such as nanotechnology, stem cells, and nuclear energy. The discovery of a truth in nature, of a tradition, a valuable law, or an element in the nature and science created by God can help you to realize a scientific point. Then that point will become science. Information will be compiled, improved upon, and led to technology and other such things.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یه نکته دیگری که در باب نخبگان وجود داره من قبلها هم یه وقتایی به این اشاره کردم این است که یکی از هدفهای جامعه علمی کشور نه فقط نخبگان همه جوامع علمی البته در مورد نخبگان این بیشتر مورد نیاز هست این است که باید به مسائل کشور فکر کنن مسئله محور کار کنن
Another point about the academic elite, which I have mentioned once before as well, is that one of the goals of the country's scientific community, not just the academic elite, but all the scientific community, should be to think about the issues troubling the country and work in a problem-orientated way.
Guide me
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the Yellow Vests started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing. Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations. In Paris, one of the Yellow Vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media, and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude them. They both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organisations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over. The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following a meeting with the signatories of the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, Iran calls for a reasonable, documented and rational response to its proposals for the removal of US sanctions and Iran's return to full compliance. Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani said Britain, France and Germany were not happy with some of Iran's proposals.
They had no complaint about these proposals being irrelevant, but they say
they are not consistent with our viewpoints, and I told them this is natural. We are not supposed to express ideas that are in line with your viewpoints. We take our own interests and policies into consideration. The important point is that they are based on principles that all sides agree on. No European side claims that Iran's proposals lack legal basis.
A diplomatic source close to the Iranian negotiating team said the country's proposed drafts were in complete conformity with the JCPOA, adding it was regrettable that some European sides were attempting to dictate their own demands round the negotiating table while failing to acknowledge that a revival of the deal requires compliance by all sides.
I think the current administration, what it is saying is that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, good or bad, is something that Iran's accepted, and we will commit ourselves to it. However, we will not allow the other side to retain sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions, and then expect us to go back to 2015. That simply won't happen.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there were substantial challenges ahead, while time to reach an agreement was not unlimited. While Iran is calling for a rational and documented response to its proposals, European diplomats are expressing concern and skepticism. The Vienna talks are set to resume next week, when it may become more clear whether the gaps can be bridged. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
The story of how Palestine was wrenched from the indigenous people lives on. It is passed down from chest to chest, from generation to generation. Even Palestinians born outside their homeland and raised in refugee camps or elsewhere carry the story with them. Attendees at this art exhibition say living in the UK, it's even more important to show up.
I think here in Britain, given Britain's role in creating the situation for Palestinian people and its ongoing support for the Israeli government and allowing it to carry out its apartheid policies, we have a special duty here to raise awareness about the situation, to fight our government when it supplies weapons to the Israeli government and gives it its support.
I support the struggle completely. And I love the forthright strength, the samud of the Palestinian people is inspiration to anybody. Anybody with any trouble, go to Palestine and see what trouble really is.
The elderly carry the keys to their demolished houses round their necks, and the new generation educate their children on the 1948 land grab that forced out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. This art exhibition in London is part of their ongoing struggle to raise the flag for Palestine.
I'm here today to celebrate our Palestinian culture, our amazing Palestinian artists. You know, our people are talented, clearly, and it's so nice to see them use their talents to preserve our culture.
This exhibition is called Visualizing Return. It launched on the anniversary of UN Resolution 194, which calls for the immediate return of all Palestinian refugees. Visualizing Return hopes to emphasize the necessity of granting Palestinian refugees this long overdue human right.
Interestingly enough, one of the easiest citizenships to acquire is Israeli citizenship. All you have to do is to prove that you have a Jewish grandparent or a Jewish spouse. But there is a Palestinian diaspora 6 million strong, and they are not allowed to return to their homeland.
The Israeli regime wants to maintain a Jewish majority. If the diaspora were allowed to return, they would by far outnumber the Jewish population. So 73 years into occupation, the demographic war rages on. Exiled Palestinians are raising awareness, but on the front line of this struggle are the men, women and children holed up in the largest open-air prison in the world, the Gaza Strip. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In its latest annual report, Italy's Center for Social Studies and Policies, CENSIS, has found that some 2 million Italian families were in absolute poverty in 2020, a rise of more than 100% on 2010. This is due to the outbreak of COVID-19 that has accentuated a sense of vulnerability in the country. Census report shows that over 40% of Italians feel insecure, while students suffer increasing levels of depression, anxiety, and existential angst.
The COVID-19 pandemic has made more workers vulnerable to pay discrimination, loss of income, and exploitative practices. The socioeconomic malaise, which was already worrying before the pandemic, is today very much widespread to all layers of the population.
The company we work for refuses to meet us to discuss the terms of our contract as the pandemic is completely changing the way we work. This is unacceptable.
Over the past months, hundreds of large and smaller protests have been staged across Italy, with workers from both the public and private sectors expressing deep concern over their deteriorating rights situation. On Friday in Rome, employees from Sogei, the information and communication technology company of the Ministry of the Economy and Finance, held a demonstration demanding to negotiate new smart working guidelines with the employer. Also on Friday, farmers from an area north of Naples staged a protest near the Agriculture Ministry, calling the government for financial assistance. Hundreds of small farming companies have gone bankrupt as the large-scale retail trade has preempted small entrepreneurs.
We haven't been allowed to be here in big numbers due to the COVID restrictions. The government must help us. We are asked to observe the most stringent food regulations when it comes to our products, but fruit and vegetables full of pesticides coming from Morocco and other countries are let in without controls. Furthermore, we haven't received a penny from the EU aid funds to farmers. When the money lands into the regional government's account, it simply disappears.
On Friday, Rome and Milan were both affected by a public transport four-hour strike called by the General Union of Labour, UGL. The nationwide action was called by unionists against the obligation for workers to have the Green Pass, a certificate proving the holder has been vaccinated, tested negative, or recovered from COVID-19. Max Civili, Rome.
Abdullah Al-Ghamdi is a Saudi rights campaigner living thousands of miles away from home. But even here, he isn't safe from tactics used by the Saudi regime to silence dissenters.
They attacked my mom and my little brother in Jeddah. In the same time, they attacked my father and another brother in Dammam. My brother in Dammam, they take him for 3 years. Nobody know where is he. But after three weeks, after 3 weeks, they release him, but they ask him to talk about me.
Abdullah and fellow rights campaigners are trustees of London-based human rights organization Sana. Here at a press conference ahead of releasing their first report on Saudi rights abuses titled I Fear for My Mother, compatriot Fahd Al-Ghawaidi has experienced the heavy hand of the Saudi regime more than once.
Believe it or not, I was selling books on the street. And the Saudi regime back then was, until now, he was, the knowledge is forbidden for the people in Saudi Arabia.
Another dissident had an entirely different experience. Journalist Jamal Khashoggi, killed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018 to send a chilling message. Yet these campaigners say the murder has redoubled their resolve.
Jamal Khashoggi is dead now, but the idea of Jamal Khashoggi is still alive, and it will be alive and remembered in our minds and in our heart forever.
The activists here say that the hopes of real reform in Saudi Arabia under the current regime are slim. That what is needed is real radical change, a revolution, and that's exactly what the current regime in Saudi Arabia cannot stomach.
They also believe the royals of Riyadh would not be able to maintain their human rights abuses without the support of Western governments, including the UK, a major supplier of weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Politicians pursue monetary and other personal interests, and in doing so, they overlook human rights abuses, even when it comes to matters which go against their own principles, such as freedom of speech and of expression.